The island of Malta is a rocky paradise in the Mediterranean Sea, strategically situated between Muslim North Africa and Christian Europe. Italy, most closely. Today, it is a vacation destination for wealthy Europeans who seek a quiet, luxurious getaway. But in 1565, it was the scene of one of the most desperate battles in the war between Islam and Christianity. How many of you know about that battle? How many of us have heard about the Siege of Malta? One historian puts it this way: if Sultan Mustafa had prevailed at the Siege of Malta, we would all be speaking Turkish and building mosques instead of churches. The Ottoman Turks had been planning an invasion of Christian Europe for years, and the consensus among the Sultan's generals, and the princes of the Austrian Empire too, by the way, was that the island of Malta was a critical strategic objective. Queen Elizabeth I looked on at the confrontation and quipped, "If the Turks shall prevail against the island of Malta, it is uncertain what further peril might follow to the rest of Christendom." That was an eloquent understatement. Another historian calls the Siege of Malta the battle for Stalingrad of the Christian West. And those who are familiar with the Siege of Malta know that the island was bravely and impossibly defended by the Knights Hospitallier, later known as the Knights of Malta, led by the legendary hero John de la Valette, Grand Master of the Knights Hospitallier. These knights, 700 of them, with 1,000 or so Spanish infantry, withstood over 40,000 Muslim invaders. One of the unsung heroes of the Siege of Malta is a man named Captain de Miranda of Sicily, which island was most directly threatened by the Ottomans after they'd taken Malta. And in the debate among John de la Valette's advisors about where the meager defenses should be deployed, Miranda argued forcefully that they should make a stand at the fortress city of San Elmo. It was almost impregnable, and if they could hold it, Malta would never be taken. Well, eventually his advice was taken, and the rest is history, as they say. The Ottoman Sultan Mustafa calculated that it would take 4 days to besiege and take St. Elmo. Miranda saw to it that, in fact, it took 30 days to finally overcome the city. Reminiscent of Davy Crockett and Jim Travis at the Alamo centuries later, and it is reminiscent of, if you like reading history and you like reading in the history of the Alamo, you'll love this story. Miranda would die later defending St. Elmo. Paul Fregosi, in his book, Jihad, an excellent book on the history of Muslim aggression, he says, unable to stand because of his wounds, Miranda had been eased into a chair and, sword in hand, awaited the Turks in a breach in a fort wall. He was overwhelmed in the final Muslim assault, unquote. But it was not for naught. Instead of sailing on for Sicily and eventually all of Europe, the Ottoman Turks returned home, intimidated by a force being assembled against them, much like at the Alamo. Houston was building an army and would later defeat General... what's his name? Anyway, yeah, all right. But they were also seriously weakened by their failure to take Malta outright. Out of a force of over 40,000 Janissaries brought to Malta, only 10,000 returned unhurt to North Africa under Sultan Mustafa. That's quite an attrition rate. Despite its profound significance to history, this battle is not well known. Those who have studied it may know of a few of the principals, Grandmaster John de la Valette, Sultan Mustafa, perhaps, and even Queen Elizabeth. But how many have remembered, perhaps the bravest and savviest of Malta's leaders, Captain de Miranda? Well, today, Koheleth recounts a parable of a poor wise man who by his wisdom defended a city as well besieged, and yet no one remembered him. Redemptive history is filled with Captain de Mirandas, men with wisdom and bravery, and yet forgotten by history and even their own generation. Well, let's look to this phenomenon in our text today, shall we? 3 points I want to make with you from the text. You have your outline there before you. Point number one, court. The setting of course for this text and so much of Ecclesiastes is the court of the king. And if indeed Ecclesiastes was written and designed to help train up his sons behind him, Solomon and his sons, then this makes perfect sense. As indeed that is our postulate, that this is a training manual, if you will, at least for the mind and the heart and the spirit for the descendants of Solomon as they take their place in court. Court. When in service to a government official, do not expect appreciation for sacrificial service. Verses 13 through 16 sounds like the voice of experience, doesn't it? What a creative and enigmatic parable. He spins for our day as well. It is for Solomon a metaphor, a trophy, an example, verse 13, of wisdom under the sun. That's a phrase, of course, for what is observable in our experiential world. What is true in a philosophical world apart from biblical wisdom? And it seemed great to Koheleth because of its universal application across human experience. Against all odds, wisdom prevails. That which is small, in our parable, a little city composed of few men and saved by a poor wise man. Against that which is great, humanly speaking, that is, a great king, many mighty siege works, and a foolish shouting king. What is the crucial difference? It is, of course, wisdom versus folly. In the actual outworking of redemptive history, the city was saved by the poor wise man, not because he was poor, which is a virtue of the Marxist, of course, the proletariat, right? Socialist in modern society. Not because he was poor, but because he was biblically wise. We are not told the precise modus operandi by which this wise man saved the city. Did he negotiate favorably and cleverly with his enemy? Did he develop a secret weapon? Had his own Manhattan Project with which he threatened the besiegers? Did he make his city appear stronger than they were in reality? We don't know. But only that by his wisdom he did, in fact, save the city. This he did by his chokmah, his wisdom. A great deal of energy has been expended by scholars trying to identify the precise historical reference here. It's a good topic for a thesis if you want to get your master's in biblical studies, right? Was it Archimedes saving of Syracuse from the Romans by sinking their ships in 2012 or 212 B.C.? Or was it the besieging of Dor by Antiochus the Great in 218 B.C.? Or the besieging of Bethsura by Antiochus the Fifth? The rescue of Athens by Themistocles? The besieging of Abel by Berthmaaca in 2 Samuel 20? Or the deliverance of Thebes in Judges 9? All these have been postulated, but none of them quite fit. But as perplexing as this may seem on its face, remember what St. Augustine observed very long ago. He says, let your overwrought curiosity be satisfied with this. Solomon notes for us that this incident has sunk into the mists of forgetfulness. Augustine, this incident has sunk into the mists of forgetfulness, which is one of the points he's trying to make. Solomon. The primary point meant to be delivered by this parable is what Koheleth observes about the net effect of his labors. Yet no one remembered that poor man. No one zakar. That's a common motif throughout the scriptures and the wisdom literature in particular. Do you remember? Part of wisdom is remembering. And we, just as at this Thanksgiving season, the grateful heart will remember the goodness of God. A thankless heart is a graceless heart, isn't it? But a thankful heart is a graceful heart. Remember the Zakar motif. Remember it at this time of year. This theme is one that's coming around again. Right? This book is a cyclical book with themes and motifs returning again and again, surfacing again and again, each time a little fuller, each time we grow that motif and theme a little bit more as the cycle progresses. No one remembers from generation to generation. As Solomon has said in chapter 1, there's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be. For the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, he has said in chapter 2, seeing that in the days to come all will have been forgotten. The wise dies just like the fool. The Zakar motif. How fleeting. How vaporous the remembrance of what we've covered previously, right? Much less even the wise Savior. As Jesus puts it himself, about himself, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household, right? Yet in the last analysis, Koheleth does not sink into despair, okay? It's not vanity or meaninglessness that is being talked about here in terms of remembrance. It's the fleetingness, right? And that coheres much better with the text than does the idea of vanity and meaninglessness. He says, and he's emphatic, but I say that wisdom is better than might, though the poor man's wisdom is despised and his wisdom is not heard. It's like Pilate refused to hear the counsel of his own wife when it comes to Barabbas and Jesus. Well, this idea of wisdom being better than might is practically applied in the next verses as well, which brings us to point number 2. Court. Our setting is Solomon's court, where he hopes his sons, after being trained and disciplined in part with this book, Ecclesiastes. When in the service to a government official, do not expect discernment of wisdom from him. chapter 9:17 through chapter 10, verse 1. Some of these chapter and paragraph divisions may seem a little disjointed, but that's just because of the English layout of this of the chapters here. They don't exactly cohere with Solomon's ordering of them. So that's why we have kind of a disjointed outline here today, seeming to be disjointed. Well, these verses constitute a brace of Proverbs, three of them, with a common theme. That is, the input of one fool can destroy the careful counsel of many wise men. And he's obliquely telling us this, especially when it's the decider in chief, as President Bush was fond of saying. He was the decider in chief. How often we see this replicated on the stage of history, as well as in our own personal lives. In the fateful year 216 BC, the great Carthaginian general, Hannibal, set a trap for his Roman counterpart, General Terentius Varro, at Cannae. That's in south-central Italy. Hannibal was a master of the art of war. He knew his enemy. Varro was impetuous and brash. He was prone to letting his temper get the better of him and acting upon the impulse of his temper rather than good counsel. Hannibal taunted him and set a trap for the 70,000 Roman troops under his command. Varro was supposed to wait for his counterpart, Paulus, to meet up with him, but rashly committed his forces to battle when he thought he had Hannibal trapped. Instead, Hannibal, knowing Varro would do this, sprung his ambush and annihilated every last trooper in Varro's legions. One historian notes with profound respect, how long does it take to kill 70,000 men by the sword? Apparently, about 6 hours, the time it took for Hannibal to utterly butcher Varro's legions, unquote. It was the greatest single defeat for Rome in her history. Varro ignored good counsel. He was the poster boy, if you will, for verses 17 and 18. The words of the wise heard in quiet are better than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. How then was Hannibal ultimately defeated? By a general wiser than him, General Quintus Fabius. Fabius realized that Hannibal was indeed a tactical genius. Whenever Rome faced him in regular pitched battle, he would defeat whatever Rome could throw at him. But Fabius also realized that despite this genius and the bravery and resourcefulness of his Carthaginian troops, they were a long way from home and had to live off the land. They couldn't ultimately hold any territory that they won in battle. And so Fabius waged a war of attrition on Hannibal, destroying small foraging parties sent out to look for food and supplies. He drew Hannibal into terrain where he couldn't fight large pitched battles. And additionally, he moved populations in front of his armies and destroyed crops and food supplies that he might use, a burnt earth strategy. It took a long time, but eventually Hannibal's army was so reduced that he fled the Italian peninsula altogether. Rome intuitively blanched at this strategy, though, preferring the confrontational pitched battle model. Fabius was dismissed initially from his command. As one historian puts it, though militarily successful, the Fabian strategy was a political failure. Then came Cannae, and Fabius was recalled. And eventually he proved successful. Well, ever since, this strategy developed by Fabius, a strategy of attrition by small incremental steps, little by little, winning small victories here and there, has borne his name. The Fabian strategy, it's called. In fact, it's been employed politically, classically by the Fabian Society. There's a whole socialist society named after this general, socialist and progressive, and it's precisely how liberalism has been victorious in England and America. Solomon knew this all too well. Sounds like the voice of experience again. The input of one fool can destroy the careful counsel of many wise men. Hence our cliche, a fly in the ointment, right? Right from the scriptures. In fact, despite this valuable tract, this valuable educational tool for the royal family of Solomon here, what will happen to his immediate heir, right? Rehoboam. What does Rehoboam go out and do? Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. Your father made our yoke heavy, the people said. Now, therefore, lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke on us, and we'll serve you. And so he goes to seek counsel from the old men who advise him to do precisely this. But, as the text says, he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. When he asked them what he should do, ask them what he should do. He says, thus you'll speak to this people who said to you, your father made our yoke heavy, but you lighten it for us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger is thicker than my father's thighs. And now, whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions. And of course, it was to your tents, O Israel, right? And we see the division of Israel into the 10 tribes and 2 tribes. Fool. Rehoboam was a fool, though he had this tract before him. In fact, Koheleth seems almost to foreshadow the bad company with whom his son will consort. That brings us to point 3. Verses 2 through 4. Our context is the court. When in service to a government official, do not expect support for wisdom from colleagues. Verses 2 through 4. Colleagues. We can say unequivocally that Solomon was a conservative, right? A wise man's heart includes him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. No. That is a scenario we superimpose on the text. That's eisegesis to the extreme. In reality, the right hand was the hand of strength and blessing. Most men are right-handed, and we see it throughout the scripture. In fact, in Latin, the word for right is dexter, when we get our word dexterous from it. And of course, the Latin for left hand is sinister. Sinister, yeah. The nuns would smack kids in their class if they tried to write with their left hand or do anything with their left hand, right? And we see this reprised throughout the scripture. I have set the Lord always before me because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Joseph saw that his father, that is Jacob, laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, and he took his father's hand, that is his right hand, to move it. Put your right hand on Manasseh's head. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, Matthew says, before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people from one another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, and he will place the sheep on his right, but sorry to say, Deb, the goats on his left. Right? And after, after raising goats for all these years, I can see why they are a metaphor for the damned. But the right hand was the hand of favor, of course. And so the allusion that Solomon makes here is not political, but theological. The wise tend to blessing, the fool to folly. In the council of the king, which is our context, this can pit one counselor against another. Only in time and over extended periods can the wise be discerned from the fool. And this is another reason politics is called a blood sport. Advisors often vie with one another for the attention and the ear of the boss. Ronald Reagan deliberately fostered competition among his inner cabinet and White House advisory team. This is one reason he had such a high turnover on his staff. But it did tend to bring out the best advice, eventually. It burned out man after man, causing animosity and competition and jealousy that still endures to this day. George H.W. Bush said of Reagan's chief of staff, Donald Reagan, she says, I still hate that SOB. And it proves Truman's advice, though. If you want a friend in Washington, D.C., go buy a dog. Here, in the Council of the Wise, the fool eventually displays his colors. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he is a fool. Solomon picks up a common theme in the wisdom literature, direction, or lack of it. The Hebrew word for direction, or for the way, is derech. One who wanders from the way, the derech, of good sense will rest in the assembly of the dead. The wisdom of the prudent, Proverbs 14:8 says, the wisdom of the prudent discerns his way, that is his derech. And Proverbs 13:6 says, righteousness guards him whose way is blameless. His derech is blameless. But sin overthrows the wicked. So when Kahalas says that even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, there's humor in the Bible, as we discuss from time to time. That's one of Jim's favorite themes, is that there is humor in the Bible. And here we're meant to see this foolish character lacking sense when he's on the road. He says to everyone, he is a fool. And he's alluding there to the careful preparations it takes to travel by foot in the ancient Near East. When Jesus told his disciples, for example, to carry no money bag, no knapsack, no sandals, and greet no one on the road as they went about preaching, he was going against conventional wisdom, right? You took your money bag because there would be provisions along the road that you would need to make. And you would take a knapsack because in the Middle Eastern climate, it may be hot and blistering in the daytime, but very, very cold at night. And anybody who didn't take an extra pair of sandals is equivalent today to not carrying a spare tire, right? And greet no one on the road. Well, in the ancient world, you traveled and you had to have connections along the way of your route, at least of friends or neighbors or relatives with whom you could stop. And since Verizon reception was very low in those days and you couldn't always text ahead of time, you surprised your contacts on the road. So all of these things needed to be in place, and only the fool traveled without them. And Kohelas' advice in verse 4 as well sounds like the voice of experience. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Isn't that another motif, not only in Ecclesiastes, but also throughout the scriptures, throughout the Proverbs? It's reported that Kamala has a raging temper, which she vents on her staff continuously, especially when she's made to look foolish in the media. So she must be in a constant state of temper, right? And she's had an 80% turnover rate as vice president in her staff, far excelling even Ronald Reagan, who's approached 50%, right? The remaining 20% of her staff should get medals, congressional medals, right? And they must be following Kohelas' advice here. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Once again, this is reprised throughout all the Proverbs. Proverbs 15:1 famously, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Or Proverbs 12:18, there is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. I like that one even better than 15:1, I think. There was one whose wrath, and we've all experienced this. There are some people whose words can be just like sword thrusts to us, right? But the tongue of the wise brings healing. Beautifully done. And we see in this ironic counsel, we see this reprise, for example, in the biblical story of Ahithophel. The advice that Ahithophel gives to Absalom. When Esau counseled as to should he pursue David, his own father, now that he had been set back on his heels, should he pursue him? give your counsel. What shall we do? And ironically, Ahithophel gives the right advice. That is, chase down David while he's weak and on the run before he can resupply and gather more men. But he does not count on the foolishness of Absalom, who ignores it and takes the crafty advice of Hushai, right? Who deliberately gives foolish advice to help save David. And Hushai says, delay until you can build up strength, because everyone knows what a valiant warrior David is. Well, what then does the smart and intelligence is not always coterminous with being wise, right? Ahithophel was smart but not wise. He's a fool for betraying the Lord's anointed in the first place. And he puts his affairs in order, saddles his donkey, and goes on to another job. No, he hangs himself. So we see with greater and greater clarity the corruption and fallibility of government and those who rule. That brings us to point four. Verses 5 through 7, chapter 10, court. When in service to a government official, do not expect wisdom to be exalted above folly. The evil which Koheleth observes proceeds from the ruler, he says. Folly is glorified above wisdom. Woe to the land in which this is done. The rich here is a metaphor for the wise man of achievement. Folly is exalted, wisdom is debased. Slaves ride, princes walk. There's a dynamic that takes place in the human heart that seeks to constantly innovate, to try the new, to overturn what is proven to be godly, fruitful, and biblical. It happened in Israel. Give us a king like the other nations. Make us a golden calf like the other nations. Solomon, dearest, set up an altar to Asherah, his wives would say, in the high places, like a head at home, right? And, of course, this phenomenon happens in Christian cultures and societies, too. Jean-Jacques Rousseau hated God and the church and advocated returning to man's natural state, quote unquote. That is, his wild and uncultivated nature, which is purer and more democratic. We hear a lot about that, don't we? How true. How true. The native pagan state of the human heart. He gave France what's come to be known simply as the Reign of Terror. Karl Marx hated God and built upon Rousseau, advocating atheistic communism, overturning Christ, constitution, and capitalism. All of these and more in our own day, that is, secularism, state, and socialism instead of Christ, constitution, and capitalism, all of these assert that although Christ, constitution, and capitalism may be good, well, secularism, state, and socialism is even better. In fact, according to Marx, it is the inevitable progress to which all of history is moving. The covenant family is that upon which Western society has built a rich culture and heritage. The gender-free marriage will be even better. Labor built on one's own self-interest and the interest of his family and community has brought untold wealth and prosperity to millions over many generations. But labor built from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Catchy little phrase, isn't it? Supposed to be even better, but deadly. Folly. Christ and his gospel is that upon which the church has flourished and grown and spread throughout the earth as the waters cover the sea. But we now know that religion is mere ignorant superstition, and atheism is even better. Your rulers have set fools to riding, while the Prince of Peace walks in great humility. What fools they are. What fools we are if we buy their lies and follow in their footsteps. Zedekiah was a fool for ignoring the counsel of Jeremiah, as we read today, right? Casting him into the cistern. Pilate was a fool for releasing the murderer Barabbas, executing the innocent man Jesus. It is the very definition of this proverb: slaves on horses, princes walking on the ground. Folly. But there is a folly that saves as well. A folly that God knows and reveals to us in the gospel, right? Paul says, "For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart." Where is the one who is wise, Paul says? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom. And Ecclesiastes is a tract on that, isn't it? The world does not know God through wisdom, earthly wisdom that is. It pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. So there is a folly that saves. The folly of the gospel. Well, may you become the wisdom of God this day by believing in the folly of the cross, the wisdom from God that saves your very soul. Let us now come to that place then where we find the mystery of the cross enfolded in the simple elements of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.